Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the USS Enterprise.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, the Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
Just want to check in with you, Ben. How are things going? How's that body, specifically? You have any way of telling me that?
Well, I imagine that this is inspired by the fact that I tweeted a picture of a model of a healthy human colon this morning.
I texted you almost immediately after seeing that.
I didn't mean to rub that in your face. I didn't want you to see that and feel like I was colon shaming you.
Hashtag colon goals. Yeah. Regarding that photograph, were those two healthy colons, or was that healthy on the left and unhealthy caramel filled on the right?
I think that it was a drawing of a healthy colon and then the model of a healthy colon.
When you asked Dr. Soren what normal was, he gestured to your body and said, "It is what everyone else is and what you are not."
My health insurance changed and I had my first physical with my new general practitioner today, and somehow I got put in the examination room that had the picture of the healthy colon and then just a big wall poster of a prostate exam. So like right next to my head, like I was sitting there for like 5 minutes before I noticed it. I turned my head to the left and in cross section, there's a finger going into an anus and touching a prostate.
Ben, were you turning your head to the left because you were told to do that and cough and that was what you saw?
That didn't happen, which really surprised me.
Oh.
Because I thought that was like part of the annual physical.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
But I've had hernia surgery, so maybe, and I told the doctor that, so maybe when she heard that, she said, "I don't need to do the thing where I check to see if he has a hernia."
Wow. Do you like this doctor? How did you choose this doctor also? I have so many questions.
Well, some men choose their doctor, Adam, but some men have their doctor thrust upon them. And this was just the one that came with the HMO that we're on now.
Wow.
I guess I could have shopped around a little bit, and I just don't have enough of whatever it takes to believe in yourself enough to, I don't know. This doctor was fine, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I resemble that remark. When we changed insurance providers, we were cut loose from our old doctors and dentists and sent to look for our own. And I, like, back when I had a Facebook page, I, like, put it out to my local friends. I was like, "I'm looking for a local Dr. Cottle from Battlestar Galactica. Like, I want an old doctor who doesn't want to see me all the time and won't force prescriptions on me. Like, what do you like?" And then I found that doctor and I've been with him ever since.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, I think I went in there thinking maybe I should get some anti-anxiety medication.
Mm.
And I asked about it and she said, "Well, that stuff's pretty addictive. So I wouldn't really recommend it unless, you know, a specialist prescribes it." And she seemed like she would be open to prescribing it to me if I felt really strongly about it, but strongly recommended against it. And I think that's a good sign in a physician.
I think so too. I think you want to, I mean, look, we're not dispensing healthcare advice on the show. That's fucked up.
No.
But personally, I feel like triangulation is good. And a baseline from your general physician, a baseline feeling of let's do it if we have to, not just because we're trying stuff out,
yeah,
is a pretty good feeling.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So you're like a car that just went in for a bunch of service. You had the dentistry did go well.
Other day and, I had a very painful dentist exam, which was not great timing.
Yeah. It's but, never great timing.
No. Yeah. So, I don't know. Mostly feeling okay about my health, though, so that's good.
It's better to know than to not know, in my opinion. At least it's not a mystery.
Yeah, and I've been feeling like I am now a 35-man, and I think this is
the... I often forget that.
This is the time in life when you have to start, making a point of getting in there regularly. Like, it was a pretty rare occurrence through my 20s that I would go into the doctor's office, mostly because I didn't have insurance for a lot of that time.
Yeah.
And I now, am fortunate enough to have a wife who has a real job and can be on her insurance, and I need to take care of myself.
Boy, a period could have come at any point in that statement, and it would have all been good. Agreed, man.
Well, do you want to get into the episode? We have a bit of a spesh ep today, don't we?
Yeah, and sort of on theme for our Marin Open, right?
Yeah, doing the work, you know?
Yeah.
We landed on an nth degree square, the nth degree square, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
In the game of buttholes, the will of the prophets. And that means you and I have both participated in extensive research for this episode. So this will be one of those episodes that we really get to it. Get, you know, like all the nitty-gritty details of how this episode was made, little factoids, things people might not know. You know, yeah. We really got to the heart of it.
I think we did. This is a very special episode, right?
Yeah, special.
Let's get to it, Ben. This thing is teed up and ready to kick. It's Deep Space Nine, Season 4, Episode 3, Hippocratic Oath.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No. Of course you don't.
Now, we start in Quark's bar, and I actually have, I thought I'd just kick it off right here with a factoid about this opening shot.
Okay.
Because Quark, of course, is pouring a glass of prune juice for everybody's favorite Klingon addition to the cast.
Mm-hmm.
But also on the tray are a couple of glasses of rosé. And not a lot of people know this, but this is actually the first on-screen appearance of Lisa Vanderpump Rosé.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Boy, get a load of Quark's tunic here, Ben. I am psyched for a larger... and more varietal wardrobe for one Quark tea bartender. This garment,
it's like that novel Jennifer Government. You have the last name of the job you have.
Yeah, this is the first time it's ever appeared on screen. This really caught my eye, Ben, and I did a little bit of research about this. Costume designer Robert Blackman was so inspired by his favorite shave ice flavor combination that he constructed them into a tunic. And if you wanted to know what those flavors were, it's chocolate, blue raspberry, and red raspberry.
Wow.
Kind of a strange combo.
Yeah.
They call it the Robert Blackman at Ululani's. You can order it there anytime.
Cool. So Worf is there kind of creeping on I would describe this alien as a bootleg Morn.
Because
he's kind of in Morn's spot and he's kind of doing Morn's thing. Wordlessly drinking.
What do you think you're doing? Being all Morn. Sitting there drinking and being quiet.
If Morn ever spoke, he would come in and said, there's only room enough for one of us in this bar, and started a fight.
Yeah.
But Quark comes over to Worf and sees what he's doing there and kind of calls war fun discriminating against weird aliens.
That is the worst mugshot I have ever seen.
I kind of thought that maybe Quark had bad breath in this scene, the way Worf is recoiling from him.
Yeah, there is a choice that Michael Dorn is making here. And it's a...
it's either a choice or it's not, you know, and I couldn't get to the bottom of this, but...
It's a level of disgust that Worf feels for Quark throughout. Like, it doesn't just end here.
It's either personal disgust or just general anti-Ferengi sentiment from Worf.
Persistent, disgusting, terrible, dragon breath. Solution? Listerine.
It works.
I like this little interaction between Kira and Worf. I feel like they are two characters with fairly like hard pasts, and they're kind of in alignment on the kind of people they are, right?
Yeah, not knowing the future of the show the way you do, it feels like a good match, socially or otherwise. Like, the two warriorist characters on the show would seem to have a lot in common and would seem to be fast friends.
Yeah, and it's a little icy between them. And
yeah, it is.
I kind of think that's Worf, right? Like, he really just has his guard up with everybody.
Yeah. He kind of surveys people that he talks to from time to time on the station in a, do you see this shit kind of way?
If he is a known criminal, why does your security chief not do anything about him?
He has a level of incredulity about, like, the criminals just wandering about the station,
yeah,
free to do their thing.
Well, it's a question we've asked several times that he's asking here. Why tolerate Quark? Like, why allow him to roam free on the station? It's a great question.
We've listed his many crimes.
Yeah.
Several of them serious over the course of our show. He's not wrong.
I think that this episode is partly... This B story, I think, is in part an attempt to retcon some of that stuff.
Quark would never survive on Ruripente.
Not everybody keeps their genitals in the same place. Quark, for example, keeps them in his ears.
Yeah.
So we cut to a runabout, and this is O'Brien and Bashir, and they're heading back a little bit early from Gamma Quadrant Biosurvey, which is pretty adventurous. It's kind of just taunting the Dominion to keep running open-ended science missions like this, in my opinion.
Hard agree.
Do you think that O'Brien just hates the Jem'Hadar because they kind of look like Cardassians?
I kind of do.
He can't tell them apart.
That one card, he wanted to fuck him in a Jeffries tube, though. That had to feel good.
Yeah. Flattering, at the very least.
Right. They're having a super fun, the thing about my wife is style conversation.
Yeah.
I think anyone in a relationship kind of knows how this pattern goes, right?
Yeah. This is actually an interesting piece of trivia that I found. O'Brien is actually married to a woman named Keiko, who has apparently appeared in some episodes.
If you haven't seen an episode in the last, I don't know, 20, you might not know that.
Well, it's a good thing we did a bunch of research and found that stuff out.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's O'Brien is doing that thing of somebody who has no sense of insight. You know, he's like, yeah, he like I turned our bedroom into a workshop and my wife gets mad at me.
I think it is. It's pretty telling how differently we took this, because I was really on O'Brien's side on this. I was like, if she's not home anyway, who gives a shit? Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's kind of the side that Bashir takes, right? He's like, oh, yeah, being in your bedroom wrenching on your projects means that you're in the space that is most closely associated with your wife.
It's quite touching, really. Exactly. Exactly.
He makes an interesting point of, like, the idea that things send a message whether you are trying to or not. And O'Brien's take is, like, I'm not trying to make this a personal attack on Keiko. I just thought I'd use a tabletop there for some tinkering.
Yeah.
He did not realize that the tinkering would be at his wife.
I mean, think about it from her perspective, right? She's like gone for months at a time. She comes home for a weekend and discovers like a half rebuilt Chevy engine on a table in her bedroom.
I think O'Brien would have a better case if we hadn't seen the rest of his condo, which is spacious.
Yeah.
Like, there is room for that elsewhere.
And also lots and lots of empty places on the station that he could easily have access to.
Yeah, I mean, they were not too long ago playing fucking racquetball. Use the racquetball room.
Yeah. This conversation takes a weird left turn into, like, kind of a gay panic thing. Where O'Brien's like, I wish he was more like a man. And the doctor starts laughing at him.
So you wish Keiko was a man?
What is this, like 1996? Did this episode come out?
Yeah.
1995? Yikes. Like, how different is disco from this, you know?
It's watching this as a like archival piece of its time. I laughed at it for its like, oh, 1995. Like, it just seems like such a specific Seinfeldian, but there's nothing wrong with it kind of joke.
It
know?
Really is, yeah. It's not overtly condemnatory, but it's also a given in the logic of the scene that nobody would want to be misconstrued with being gay, which is a very 1995 approach. You know, it's like what Green Book is to racism, this scene is to it's okay to be gay.
They don't have a moment even to consider pulling out their dicks before a banger gets dropped on them, and they are like heading towards a crash landing on a nearby planet.
Yeah, I really liked the camera angle that shows the clouds rushing toward the cockpit. I feel like that's better done, and then seeing the runabout like come down under the cloud layer from an exterior angle into kind of like a, you know, like indoor forest moon looking type of environment.
A piece of trivia that I really tried to find that I couldn't was I was wondering if the POV shot of the runabout hitting the tree line was from Star Trek Generations and the saucer crash into the tree line. There's something familiar about that, and I didn't watch them back to back like I probably should have, but that looked like that. In a good way, I mean.
Yeah. No, it was a great little sequence.
So they've made a fairly soft landing, fortunately, on Bopak 3. That's the name of this planet.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, they had detected something.
Should this planet have any equine life, you could say that they would be called Bopak Horsemen.
Yeah. Good point.
I feel like a lot of my trivia is going to be of the good point variety. So buckle up.
Gold Ducat.
So they detected like something that made them think that a warp core breach had happened or a warp core failure had happened or something in the area. And it wasn't entirely clear to me like what the effect was that caused them to crash, but they don't fuck the ship up beyond repair. Like, the concern is not that they're not going to be able to take back off, and that's good. And you want to have the chief with you in a situation like this, because he can just get this thing back in the air as soon as they figure out, you know, what the crash ship situation is.
They really don't allow you to look at the crash site closely, because it really looks like the runabout has been transformed into kind of a tiki bar situation, like with the arrangement of the limbs around it. It looks like a place that you should walk up and order a drink.
Yeah, I actually found something interesting about that. This all the set elements were saved and actually converted into a tiki bar in Burbank.
Oh.
But unfortunately, it started to lose money, and then John Taffer rescued it and made it into a sports bar that specializes in ice cream cocktails. Yeah, just a little tidbit of trivia for you.
Wow, I would like to go to there. now that I'm a newly minted lactose man, I can get back out there and enjoy the ice cream beverages that I've been missing out on.
Nothing goes better with sports than a nice ice cream cocktail.
That's the truth. Give me a plastic football with a frosty ice cream cocktail inside. 44 ounces of Neapolitan ice cream and rum.
They've barely had time to comment on what a dump it smells like on this planet. It
smells like a garbage dump. I'm sorry I couldn't find a nicer place to crash land.
When a bunch of Jem'Hadars decloak in front of them and take them prisoner.
Yeah, they start in right away with the "who should we kill first" line of conversation, which is great. Like, that's, if you're ever taken hostage, I think that's what you lead with if you're a hostage taker, right? Really set the tone.
We had an episode of Disco recently where you talked about the idea of like being a patient in a hospital bed that people are talking over as though you're not there. And this conversation about who to kill really felt like that to me.
Yeah.
Like O'Brien is determined to be a high priority kill. And then they're like, well, we'll use Bashir as like the most dangerous game and like do some war games on him before we kill him. Just for funsies.
This episode makes a decision about its tone in this scene, because if they were to argue about their relative value as hostages, I think that could be fun and funny. Like, hold on a second.
He's
like,
a trained medical doctor with with a commission. I'm just an enlisted man. Leave me out of this.
I've actually been to war. I could be very useful to you. Being a race of warriors.
Yeah, but that is not what happens. This is looking pretty dire for these two.
Yeah.
So they get kind of marched off into the jungle. And we cut back to Deep Space Nine, where Worf has been hauled into a meeting with Odo.
I'm Mr. Bunkin.
And Sisko, Sisko's office. And Sisko is kind of hearing Odo out as he complains about the fact that Worf is attempting to do security, like in addition to his other duties.
Yeah.
Odo doesn't like getting his toes stepped on. And this is a conflict we've seen before when Lieutenant Toast came aboard the station. Odo had a problem with that guy also.
And in general, it's a thing you see in life, right? Like, a tryhard on paper sounds like a great person to have around.
Right.
But that quickly dissolves when toes get stepped on.
Right, and Worf...
Worf reminds me a lot of the way he was in the in that TNG couple of episodes, the Gambit episodes. Remember when Picard was Galen?
Yeah.
And he started doing missions for that pirate ship, and then Riker eventually went over to that ship too, and it made Worf first officer to Data.
Yeah.
Remember how Data had to scold Worf for his overstepping and his mission creep?
Yeah, I rewatched a little of that episode recently when I made the rain check drop.
Oh, interesting.
Because that's where that, like, I'm sorry if this has ended our friendship line comes from.
Yeah. Yeah. Worf,
interesting,
not really good at this.
To think about, like, a professional disagreement that doesn't necessarily need to end a friendship.
Yeah. Yeah. Glad those exist.
I mean, it exists in fiction.
It gives me hope.
So Sisko sort of scolds Worf about the issue, and Worf agrees to kind of knock it off, but admits that it has been a little hard for him to kick the habit of doing security.
I have occasionally not been on the side of episodes that just make Sisko into a counselor, but this is a good Sisko episode, and his counsel at a number of times in this ep feels good and real.
Yeah.
And lived in, you know?
It kind of reminds me of the counseling he gives Dax in the episode where everybody's like playing a past host about like how to deal with Curzon. It's like
was this when he was choking her out? This was the advice?
Yeah. Yeah. In between gasps, he told her. So back on the planet, Bashir makes a deal with the lead Jem'Hadar to do science in lieu of being their prey animal in the hunt. The actor playing this lead Jem'Hadar is actually the same guy that played Tosk.
That's right.
And also the shovel face Romulan in Face of the Enemy in TNG.
I love old shovel face. Yeah. Good get.
Remember shovel face?
I do. The name of this Jem'Hadar is Garanagar. And unlike the far more successful...
It's actually pronounced Garanagar.
Well, Ben, if you'll allow me to pronounce it that way, I have a joke that follows.
Oh, fine.
I'll just gather myself and reset.
Yeah.
And unlike the far more successful product lines of you know, like the liquors that Star Trek has made, like the James T. Kirk bourbon and the Scotty Scotch.
Right.
Scott McDonald actually had an idea for a salad dressing based on his character's name that unfortunately ended up being a failure. And so, sadly, he has dozens of cases of oil and Garanagar just sitting in his basement collecting dust.
Yeah, you can find that stuff on eBay, but it doesn't really have that much collectability value.
I don't apologize.
Better than the joke I wrote about that guy's name. It's okay.
Oh, shoot. Oh, I didn't know we were competing over... give me that one. I want to hear it.
Okay, just for funsies. Garanagar is actually, a lot of people don't know this, a cousin, the real guy, a cousin of Terry Gar. A lot of people don't realize that she is part Jem'Hadar.
Oh, we're keeping all of that.
The problem is that we took different stabs at how to mispronounce his name. So,
Garanagar.
That's great. That is so great. I love this show.
Garanagar, his deal is that he has kicked the white. They call the stuff that they pipe into their necks Ketracil white. And he is, he's actually gotten the monkey off his back and is no longer addicted to it. And he's convinced that there's something about the environment of this planet that has to do with it because he was marooned on this planet for long enough that he should have died from lack of supply of the drug. Of course, this drug is like the way that the Dominion keeps control over their super soldiers. It's the lysine contingency, but for super soldiers.
Right.
Dr. Wu inserted a gene that creates a single faulty enzyme in protein metabolism. The animals can't manufacture the amino acid lysine. Unless they're completely supplied with lysine by us, they slip into a coma and die.
And the fact that he's survived this led him to kind of like a revelation about whether or not he even wanted to be a part of the Dominion, and he decided he didn't, and led his men back to this planet and is now like hoping that they can go through the withdrawals and come out the other side the same way he did. But it doesn't seem to be going well. He shows Dr. Bashir a group of his soldiers who are like standing in a row, shaking. I thought this was like an episode that René Auberjonois directed.
Uh-huh.
And it was like, it was switched in shooting order with The Visitor because of something to do with Colomini's film shooting schedule.
Right.
So Auberjonois got this script kind of as a surprise and just had to go ahead and shoot it. And he hadn't like had months to prepare for it. So it was a real trial by fire. And I would say that this is one of those scenes that really shows that, like, the idea that a bunch of people suffering withdrawal symptoms would just be standing like they're waiting for a bus. Like, put those guys on cots.
God, the 16 is never on time.
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pale.
A bucket.
A pale.
Mr. Bucket,
I have to revert back to my instinct. I don't use the bucket anymore.
Garanagar's origin story is kind of magical, and it also introduces a timeline to this story and a fair amount of stress, because he has confided in Bashir and O'Brien that while his soldiers have a month's supply to get off of the shit with, that what they really have is only 5 days.
Right.
And what I found out about the story is that it almost had a religious context, because the writers considered the idea of a more religious aspect to Garanagar's appeal to his troops.
Huh.
But the story of the Ketracel White lasting for longer than predicted.
Sure.
And the Gem Hedonica story was ultimately dropped.
Are all of yours just really bad puns?
I don't know yet, Ben. I don't know.
Yeah, well, they had that was obviously in the first draft of the script, but they decided to kind of take it back to basics.
Yeah.
But Garanagar is just really worried that the new chapter of Ketracel Anonymous that he's trying to get started is not gonna pop off the way he had hoped.
Yeah, they are going to be pissed when they find out about their dwindling supply.
One moment in this when one of these soldiers is really suffering, there's kind of like a sergeant character that walks up to him and goes like, "Take the pain." And that caught my ear because it reminded me of that scene in Platoon.
Yeah.
And this scene was actually guest directed by Oliver Stone. And he actually did it, and he didn't accept any payment other than a crate of Ketracel White.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Figured out that you could dry it out and then cut it up and snort it like a rail.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing about Ketracel White is kind of looks delicious. Looks like horchata.
Yeah, yeah. Nice cinnamony flavor to it.
Yeah.
Tastes great. We have a little McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
Back on the station that is an update about what the Klingons are up to. And I thought this was a nice bit of writing just to kind of remind the viewer that all the rules are really different now. This is not an episode about that per se, but the Klingons are an active threat that we are all still worried about, but it kind of gives way to everybody leaving the room and like Worf and Odo having a bit of a chat, and Worf is giving Odo like a hot tip, like I discovered that your boy Quark found a like piece of equipment that's used for identifying a certain type of crystal. Talonian crystals, and Talonian crystals are not allowed to be taken off of the Talonian homeworld. So having a scanner to identify Talonian crystals is ridiculous unless Quark is doing something dirty.
At this point in the episode, had you taken a side between Odo and Worf?
I mean, I think that the episode is really heavily implying that Worf is unreasonably stepping on Odo's toes. I was honestly surprised that Odo took this piece of information with appreciation, you know?
I appreciate you bringing me this information, Commander.
You know, on paper, if we're just starting season 4 of DS9 and we're bringing back a beloved TNG character, I would have my doubts over whether to make Worf an unlikable person or make decisions that we don't agree with as viewers so soon into his reemergence onto a show. And I think it speaks to the ability to paint this conflict between them that, like, there was never a side when I was on, there was never a moment when I was on Worf's side of this.
Yeah.
Like, I was always with Odo, and I would not have expected that given how much I love TNG and how new Deep Space Nine is compared to my relationships between the two characters, you know?
I feel like there's a math of we love this character and we can see him do something bad this early on and not lose our love for him.
Yeah.
You know, like they can kind of afford to spend Worf on a scene like this.
And also Worf never had the reputation of being a character who was right all the time,
right,
or particularly good at things. Like his excellence as a Starfleet officer was what exactly? And I don't mean that to be like super disparaging of Worf, which is a character I really like, but like he's not a...
Yeah, I mean, there's like that super cut of Worf getting shot down whenever he suggests something.
Yeah.
And yeah, like the idea that he is an imperfect character is well established, I guess.
And I think that serves the story that's being told here, for sure.
Madam, have you ever considered a career in security?
If it's anything like babysitting, I'm an authority.
O'Brien and Bashir are, like Bashir kind of arranges for O'Brien to be allowed to assist him in his research, but O'Brien is just secretly building weapons to try and kill the Jem'Hadar, while Bashir looks for a way to cure these guys of their Ketracil addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a pretty funny scene where O'Brien's like rigged up a garden hose to shoot lightning bolts out of it, and they it hits like one of the Jem'Hadar is inspecting it when it hits one of his buddies, and he almost chokes O'Brien to death, but they decide at Garanagar's orders,
I said release him,
to return him to his holding cell. And one thing that happens a bunch of times in the episode is the more junior Jem'Hadars are always looking to kill somebody for something, and Garanagar is always getting in between them and that. And like, including the guy that got hit with the lightning bolt, he's got like a big gash on his leg and he's like, kill me, this is great, you guys are gonna have so much more of the Ketracil now.
If the death of one will make the rest stronger, then he dies.
Logic clearly dictates that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Garanagar's like, no, that's not what we're doing. We're not playing the games that the founders make us play.
We came here to be free of the Vorta. It is time to stop living by their rules.
Because the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many.
And that really makes a big impression on Bashir. You know, he's talking to O'Brien about how like Garanagar's forming his own morality, like kind of as an emergent property of not being brainwashed anymore. He's like starting to come up with his own worldview and stuff. I thought that was pretty interesting.
There's a deep sadness in the idea of serving a master that you've never met and can never know. And that was one of the things that Garanagar mentions, is like he's never seen a founder in real life. Like he's getting orders several steps above his station. And that's part of the reason that he doesn't want that life anymore. He doesn't understand it, and he doesn't know who he's taking orders from.
It's a crisis of faith. And, you know, he used to be very confident in saying, my God is gloppier than your God, when he was, you know, on some planet subjugating some people. But now he doesn't even know, man.
Bashir's interest in freeing Garanagar and the rest of his crew from the White feels very parallel to the questions brought up when the idea of freeing the Borgs was posed, and like creating a circumstance where independence could be achieved for them.
Right. Yeah, and it I mean, like the case he makes to O'Brien, who is hearing none of it, by the way.
Yeah.
Is that the Jem'Hadar are slaves. Like they've been subjugated just like everybody else that isn't a founder in the Dominion. And I thought that was a pretty compelling argument, you know? I could really see both sides of that.
Yeah, that's what makes the scene great, is not only that they're good buds, but that they both have really strong arguments here.
And it turns into a thing where Bashir has to fall back on his rank to win the argument. He orders O'Brien to go, you know, get some equipment out of the runabout. And, you know, you can just see O'Brien rethinking not becoming an officer. Like, got out of all those banquets, but now I got to fucking eat a plate of shit served to me by Julian Bashir.
Yeah. Yeah, that can't feel good. Interesting that like they never bring up the friendship during the argument either.
I think that's
wise. I think that getting back to that argument that Data and Worf had back in the day, like interesting that Data was the one that did.
Right.
In circumstances like this.
Yeah. It's really interesting to see their friendship tested because it's always felt like a friendship of convenience primarily. Mm. They're such different guys. But I think it's clear when they disagree that it really distresses both of them.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want to be on either side of an issue like this.
Much like the conflict between Bashir and O'Brien, there's some unrest among the troops in Garanagar's care, particularly with Arak Taral, who doesn't like what Garanagar's become, man. You've changed. You were cooler when you were using the white, man. We used to party. It was awesome.
You need to lighten up. You're such a bummer. Fucking harsh my chill every day.
Yeah. Yeah, real vibes. Real recovery vibes, I feel like.
Yeah, yeah. Alamarin, come to Fort. Alamarin, come to Fort. What are you doing? What are you doing? Mind, what are you doing now? Ow! 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 Picard, 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 Picard. Exactly. Garanagar is trying to start Ketracel Anonymous, and it's becoming clear that Worf needs, like, Security Anonymous.
Yeah,
because he is now snuck into Quark's bar after hours to secretly watch as Quark makes an illicit deal for these Talonian crystals with this bootleg Morn guy, and Worf kind of like rappels down from the ceiling with a dustbuster like, "Ha ha! I foiled your dastardly plot, Quark."
I don't know what made me think of this other than Worf's posture here, but he creeps in from the side of the frame like Chris Hansen from To Catch a Predator.
And what's going on here seems pretty pervy, doesn't it?
You know?
Yeah.
Like, he's so chill in his gotcha moment.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, Quark.
Why don't you put the Mike's Hard Lemonade down?
Yeah.
Talk to me for a while.
Why don't you sit down over there? And then it turns out Odo is the Mike's Hard Lemonade.
Yeah, yeah, the six pack that Quark bought to barter for the for the crystals with goes gold, and Worf drops it on the floor, and Odo appears, and it becomes clear that Quark was actually in on a fairly sophisticated sting whereby Odo was going to go aboard this guy's ship disguised as Mike's Hard Lemonade. And if he could avoid getting drunk, he would then follow the ship back to the whatever criminal syndicate this guy works for. And Worf, like, it's like one of those interagency fuck-ups where, like, the DEA and the FBI are onto the same stash, you know?
Yeah, you see it all the time in cop show.
You really do.
The genre,
right?
You know?
Yeah. So Odo gets to kind of flaunt his security chess to Worf's security checkers, but unfortunately he's going to have to settle for arresting the middleman. In this particular case,
no character on the show feels shame quite like Worf, and this is professional shame that he's made to feel, right?
Yeah,
this sucks for him,
yeah.
And it should suck.
Yeah, he is definitely blushing at the end of this scene.
Yeah,
So back at the runabout, O'Brien has used his advanced knowledge of what button to push on a runabout to cause Worf lightning to come out of a panel and distracted a Jem'Hadar, beamed himself into the forest nearby, and he goes full First Blood, right? covers a tricorder with a bunch of leaves and makes a Rambo trap.
I love this.
What you choose to call hell, he calls home.
He, meets up with Bashir. We see one of these Rambo traps actually get sprung and a Jem'Hadar get hit with a log in the face. Just a lot of fun.
Yeah, you know, Ben, the lethality of this trap was originally far greater.
Oh, yeah?
But when the scythe that O'Brien made from a sharpened panel from the runabout decapitated a stuntman, they decided to have him construct a non-lethal booby trap instead.
Holy shit. I read all about this scene because I thought it was fascinating. And one thing that I uncovered is that they actually had a couple of Ewoks on set consulting.
When asked, the Ewok said, "Yub yub." This all leads up to a climax, right? Like, O'Brien escapes. He's running through the jungle. Like, booby traps are flying off behind him. He finally gets to Bashir, and he's like, he has that moment, right? The "I've come to rescue you" moment. Everything comes to a head in this moment.
It's only 300 meters to the runabout, but those guys move fast.
And Bashir says, "I'm not going with you," and it's fade to commercial, like, dun, dun, dun.
Did you see the gag reel for this episode?
Oh, I didn't find that.
I did. It was pretty great. There's a version of this scene. God, Colomini's so great. He looks at Bashir and like Andre the Giant from The Princess Bride is like, "I've come to rescue you. I have these horses.
You'll be dead.
And then you were there." So great. Like, classic Colomini.
Yeah.
Just a cut up.
He's a cut up. Yeah, he loves to burn a take just to get everybody kind of in the mood, you know? Like Billy Bob Thornton doing a Sling Blade.
Yeah, just a delight.
It's never not going to work.
Yeah.
No more rhymes now, I mean it.
Anybody want to feel it?
But yeah, Bashir feels like he's, you know, he's kind of gone back and forth on whether he thinks he can crack this code of fixing the Jem'Hadar. And there's a point in the middle of the episode where he's like, "I don't think it's the planet. I think it's you. I think you have a genetic mutation."
Yeah.
And that actually, you know, seems like a defeat then. But then he's like, "Oh, but maybe I can, like, promulgate that mutation to more Jem'Hadar." And eventually O'Brien just has to shoot the experiment to get Bashir to agree to come with him.
Amazing moment.
Right?
I didn't think he had it in him.
It was pretty wild.
Yeah.
Kind of a terrible effect.
Yeah.
But whatever. So they're about to bounce. Garanagar, like, jumps out of the forest and discovers them. And basically, the decision is that all is lost. So might as well let these guys go because he's a chill Jem'Hadar. And he walks them to the runabout, and the guy that got Worf lightning kind of like stumbles out right at that moment and threatening to kill these two, and Garanagar actually takes him down.
Yeah. Pretty rugged. Of everyone on the planet, we probably knew this guy and his motivations the best, right? Arrak T'Ral?
Yeah. I mean, he is speaking for the standard issue Jem'Hadar motivation.
He's the number one also.
Yeah.
So this is meant to hurt the most when he's executed.
It's pretty tough. And so when he goes down, Bashir and O'Brien turn to Garanagar and they're like, "Well, you could come with us. Like, this, you know, you don't have to live out the rest of your miserable life on this yub yub planet." And he's like, "No, man. Which one of you was a soldier? You in the gold? You understand. Tell your friend."
"He's their commander. I trusted him.
You can't leave them.
They get in their Winnebago and they head off.
Bashir takes a real big city amount of beats before finally getting into the runabout, right?
He really does, yeah.
Like, they really take their time in this moment.
Yeah, I liked that.
Giving him some pause.
I liked letting it, like, the ramifications of all this wash over him because the title of the episode is Hippocratic Oath, and he really stuck to his guns on that the entire time, and it is now not even close to being an option.
Yeah. Yeah.
Morn.
Dear sweet.
Morn.
In here, buddy.
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
We get a couple of little wrap-up scenes. One is with Sisko fixing that clock from that one terrible episode. And Worf comes in to kind of, like, he read the official report that Odo wrote about arresting that guy and discovered he wasn't in it, felt bad about it, and so he's kind of coming to Sisko to mea culpa about it. And Sisko's, you know, pretty chill about it. He's like, you know, I'm not mad. It's like an adjustment period, and you're in it. This is not like living on a starship. DS9 has a lot more shades of gray. It has 50 shades of gray, to be precise. Now, how about you sign this contract, and then we can go into my dungeon. And then he puts some nipple clamps on Worf.
I love the idea that Worf is in a probationary period that he didn't know he was in. That allows for some mistakes to be made. That's basically what Sisko is saying here. He's like, this isn't like being on a ship, man. And you'll get that eventually, but you're going to make some mistakes along the way.
Yeah. Your average Federation vessel doesn't have a guy like Quark working on it.
Yeah.
Worf, yeah. He says, like, on the Enterprise, I knew who my friends were and I knew who my enemies were. And I could just see him, like, winding up to list Mott as one of his enemies. You see the fucking haircuts I had on that show?
Yeah. Season after season. I'm looking like a dope. Yeah. Great moment.
Yeah.
Moment efficiency, I think. These two scenes between Sisko and Worf that bookend the ep,
yeah,
I think are really great.
Yeah. Button on the episode is Bashir and O'Brien piloting the Winnebago back to the station, and O'Brien kind of reminding Bashir that Bashir can and maybe should charge O'Brien with some kind of dereliction of duty for disobeying a direct order. And it does really feel like their friendship has changed forever in this scene.
It really, really does. They put off the darts game, Ben.
Yeah.
It's pretty heavy.
Some wild shit.
I like seeing this moment, though. Like, there's a safety to TNG where, like, you knew no matter what, the senior staff was going to remain friends. Their conflicts were external.
Yeah.
Mostly. And I like that they're introducing some doubt here and that things that happen on missions on this show could have some consequences for the relationships between them. I think that's good.
I agree. Did you like the episode, Adam?
Yeah, I think this is one of the great episodes of season 4. But really one of the great episodes of the series, I think, so far. Really, really great argument. I love arguments where both parties seem right in their own way. And especially played out by two actors that we really like. That was solid. I have big problems with why this away mission or why the survey mission exists at all.
Right.
Like, if you can just get past that, I think you'll be very happy with this episode. What about you, Ben?
I also like the episode. I think it's really smart of them to spend some time showing Worf adjusting to life on this station in this new context. I think it's totally natural that he would have some adjusting to do, and
yeah.
it not only lets the character live in that reality, but also kind of helps us recalibrate our expectations about what he does on the show, because he serves a very different utility on this show than he did on TNG. And I think it's super smart writing to do that in this episode.
Yeah. They're really doing a "this ain't Star Trek The Next Generation" thing with Worf, huh?
They sure are, Adam. Gonna see if we have any P1 messages.
Sure do, Ben.
Priority 1 message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Our first priority one message is a call to action, Ben. And the message goes like this. This corporate P1 is to promote crying and having your wife wipe away your tears, aww, which is the greatest feeling in the world. Thank you, Ben, for being a real man and sharing. And
wow.
And the call to action is crying. Crying. Maybe crying will work for you.
I mean, this is not the first sponsorship money we've gotten from crying.
Yeah.
We do a lot of it. We're two of crying's most well-known spokespeople.
It's true. Compensated endorsers for crying.
Yeah. But nice to get a P1 from crying.
Yeah.
Man, I wish I knew what this was in reference to specifically.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Yeah.
Just crying in general.
Yeah, feels good to cry. Let it out.
Let it out.
Adam, we have another priority one message of a promotional nature here. It goes like this. Turbulenceforecast.com is a website that anxious flyers can use to see if their next flight will be turbulent or not. Aircraft bangers, if you will. You can use the freely available maps or purchase an individual forecast by email. Big fan of the pod. Mention scarves in the forecast by email to show your support.
Wow, I just went to this website and it is what it says on the box.
Yeah.
Really cool concept.
Visit turbulenceforecast.com for forecast maps or to order your own personalized forecast by email.
Very cool.
I know that my wife is a particularly anti-turbulence person, so I think she would love to know about this website. I'm going to send her a link right now.
I am a little surprised that on this website, in big bold letters, it does not say at the top that turbulence has never been the cause of a commercial air crash or fatality in the history of aviation. Like, I think that's baseline one of the things that fearful flyers should know, and that's something that I remind my wife of from time to time. Like, turbulence does not cause accidents.
Yeah, but it can be scary.
Yeah.
Even despite that.
True.
So.
True.
I think this is a useful service.
I do too. And, cool idea.
Yeah, I think I love that whoever's behind this is a fan of the show.
There's a turbulence index, Ben.
Wow.
With numbers and colors.
I'm getting some investment dollars and I'm investing in turbulence, baby.
Yeah. Well, if you have a priority one message of a emotional or commercial nature, you can take it on over to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where personal messages are $100 and commercial messages are $200, both of which keep this emotionally turbulent program going week in and week out, and we thank you.
Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Drunk Shimoda!
I think with everything we know about Chief O'Brien, his history as a legitimate warfighter, his training by Captain Maxwell,
one of the finest captains in the fleet.
Yeah. And also, like, their circumstance, right? The Jem'Hadar are uniquely lethal. They've shown a willingness and an interest to kill them. I do not understand his decision to make a non-lethal weapon. Like the whole, like that guy is smacked in the head with a log. It's a fucking Home Alone trap that he makes. I don't get that. I don't get that at all. And for that reason, O'Brien's my Shimoda. Like, rig the tricorder to explode.
Wow.
Was my vote. So yeah, I don't get that. And I think it's okay if you have O'Brien kill a guy.
Yeah.
It's okay. What about you, Ben?
My Shimoda is this the Jem'Hadar that actually gets the Ketracel White and administers it to himself. Mm-hmm. At the end of the withdrawal scene, Bashir is like overcome with sympathy for these guys, and it's like, well, give them the stuff for now. They don't need to be suffering like this while I do the research. And so they pass out some white, and we get a close-up of a guy. And the process of installing the vial of Ketracel White, it just looks like kind of putting your wallet away in your suit jacket. I just thought that was pretty fun. Like, they had the little pipes with the liquid going into their necks like seasons ago, I feel like, you know?
Yeah.
Ever since we've seen these characters, they've had a long time to develop the look and tactile feeling of installing of injecting themselves or whatever, and
they don't want us to see it going in.
Did we see it at some point in like one of the other? I don't know if we've seen it before, but it just seemed very funny to me that it would just be like, yeah, just stick it behind stick it in your breast pocket and that's all you have to do.
Especially with the composition they give it, like you're expecting to see something,
right? Yeah,
and then it just disappears behind a lapel.
Yeah, so a little silly.
Yeah, agreed. What do we have coming up on the next episode?
The next episode is season 4, episode 4, Indiscretion. Forced to bring Dakot along on a personal mission, Kira discovers the real reason her nemesis wants to accompany her. Wow, a buddy mission with Dukat and Kira.
Is this going to be a callback to when Garrick outed Dukat's crush on her? Is that going to be what this is?
Shit, dog. I don't know. You will be delighted to learn that the top that she wears in the episode where she kills the pizza oven is back in effect.
Top is back.
Yeah, I'm looking at the little thumbnail here. It's unmistakable.
That is great. Love that.
Well, Adam, this is your episode to roll them bones and find out how we will be doing said episode. Next episode is a Max Fun Drive episode, so it would be pretty wild if it was something fun.
Wouldn't it be? It would be so wild, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, we did something fun this week, so maybe people are inspired enough by that. I don't know if you had fun, but I had fun this week.
I had great fun. Great fun indeed, Ben. Just a few squares ahead, we have a Caught in the Nebula square. And I think that's the only thing in range.
Caught in the Nebula is kind of the polar opposite of an nth degree, right? Like, this would be no notes, no scrubbing into the episode, just doing our darndest to remember how the episode went and describe it back to each other.
Yeah, like a game of Star Trek telephone.
Oh, man, I cannot wait to get one of those and hear all of the corrections.
I'm just going to delete all my accounts if we get to that point.
All right, you want to roll the dice?
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
All right, in my sweaty palm, I have placed the die. And I am rolling.
Chula!
Did I win?
Hardly.
I have rolled a 2, which has plopped our runabout on square 80, inching ever closer to the Caught in the Nebula episode, but placing us firmly back into the bosom of a regular Greatest Gen ep. I would argue, because it's a Max Fun Drive episode, maybe maybe we crack a couple of brew dogs just to be festive about it.
That sounds delightful, Adam.
Yeah.
Well, that will be the next episode. Really looking forward to it.
Me too.
Get your wallets ready and your social media accounts ready for the Max Fun Drive. We need all of the help we can get, promoting the show, promoting the drive, and most importantly, new and upgrading donors. So if you already donate to support the show, thank you. Next week, consider increasing your donation because this ain't getting cheaper to do. It is getting more expensive to do. And if you don't already support the show, know that the show cannot go on if it does not improve its revenue. This is very expensive and time-consuming, and while fun, we need to keep these lights on. So if you find the show is enjoyable, please consider donating next week.
Well said, Ben. A couple of people who help make the show as good as it is include Adam Ragusea, who has created the fun riff on our theme music, as well as all of the interstitial music for the show.
And the Kirk song, which you can check out in the donor bonus episode of Greatest Gen Con, which will be hitting your bonus feed very shortly.
That's right.
If it hasn't already.
Lots of people excited for that. I'm excited for that.
I am too. Got to thank our card daddy, Bill Tilly, who makes awesome trading cards of every episode of this show and Greatest Discovery now. Bill Tilly doing double duty. He is one of the greats. And we feel really lucky to have all of the amazing fan art that pours out for this show. It's so fun to look through on social media every week. We use the hashtag GreatestGen to denote posts about it on Twitter, where Adam is at Cut for Time and I'm at Benjamin AHR. There are subreddits and Facebook groups and all kinds of different social media things. There's the Greatest Gen Wikia out there if you want to look into the origin of any of the jokes from the show. We really feel lucky to have such a great community of Friends of DeSoto out there.
We really do. It's the best part of making the show.
Yeah.
Actually, it's not the best part of making the show, Ben. You know what the best part of making the show is?
I don't.
Doing it with you.
Aw, buddy.
I really mean that, man.
I agree. The same is true for me as well.
And with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine, which brings back a treasured garment.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.